Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the investigative journalist Martin Bright. During his 20-year career, he's covered politics, religion and culture for the BBC World Service, Channel 4, The Guardian, The Observer, The New Statesman and The Jewish Chronicle. He memorably broke the 2003 story exposing pressure placed on UN members by the United States to authorise its planned military action in Iraq. The story has been made into a Hollywood movie called Official Secrets, starring Keira Knightley, Ralph Fiennes and Matt Smith, who plays Martin in the film. An advocate for social mobility, in 2009 he founded Creative Society, a charity dedicated to helping disadvantaged young people launch careers in art, design and the media. Martin, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's start with Official Secrets, which is creating a huge amount of debate. What's it like seeing yourself on screen played by Doctor Who himself, Matt Smith?
It's an undeniably surreal experience, Paul. It's everyone's dream, I guess, to be played in a Hollywood movie. You think it's never going to happen. And so to be in a position where an actor of Matt Smith's calibre is playing the younger me...
He plays it well. I know the real you.
It is extraordinary. And I can't say that I'm not delighted that that this is happening.
And do you, as the real you watching someone portray you, is that a surreal experience in the sense of that it's not an impersonation of you? It's trying to capture the essence of what you were thinking and feeling at the time. Do you ever think, I didn't quite think that at that moment?
It is a peculiar experience, and it's a peculiar experience in two ways. When we first went on set, and I was there as an advisor to the director about making the newsroom as real as possible, Matt was quite nervous. He'd just come off a big film in the States where he was playing Charles Manson, the serial killer.
And so he went from playing a serial killer to you.
He did indeed.
Wow, and
he
that's was very, a step up.
He was very jet-lagged and wasn't quite sure how he was going to do it. And also, I was there present on set.
Are you the best person to advise him or the worst person?
I think probably the worst. I mean, and I can't imagine how tricky it is to have the person you're playing on set. I mean, he was extremely decent about it. But initially, he did try to impersonate me. I'd given him various notes of how to play a down-and-dirty investigative journalist. And I said, you know, you're used to playing heroic characters before he played Charles Manson. He'd been used to playing heroic or very posh characters in the case of the Duke of Edinburgh. And I said, with journalists, you just have to realise that we're a bit sneaky, that we have kind of rat-like cunning, famously. And he did begin by trying to be really, really sneaky. And the director had to have a word with him and say, look, Matt, it's probably better if you're more yourself. And once that had happened, he really relaxed into the role. And I mean, I think his performance, I mean, it's difficult for me to say, but I think his performance is extraordinary. And then there was another element to watching the film that was very surreal, which is that even though I was being represented on the screen, the whole thrust of the film is about Catherine Gunn, the whistleblower at GCHQ, played by Keira Knightley. And as a member of the public, as a member of the viewing public, I think it's a tribute to the directing of Gavin Hood that I, like everybody else in the cinema, identify with Catherine Gunn, not with Martin Bright. So even me, the real Martin Bright, find myself identifying with every woman or, you know, the every person
that is the
hero of the piece, Catherine Gunn, yeah.
And she was a hero. I mean, I supported the Iraq intervention at the time and largely still do now, albeit with some reservations. But she had nothing but noble intent. She genuinely believed she was doing the right thing. And then when there was the investigation and her colleagues could have been thrown under the bus, she coughed to it straight away. You can't imagine a more noble act, really, and executed more nobly.
Yeah, there are all sorts of whistleblowers. And as a journalist, you can't choose your whistleblower. They come in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes they're kind of crazy people with bags full of documents, and you have to take everybody as they come because what's important is the story. Catherine, I think, is unusual in a different way. She's unusual in the fact that she's so ordinary. she's not someone who is particularly self-centred.
She's not like a Julian Assange character who's doing it for PR and self-aggrandisement.
She's not like that at all, nor did she dump hundreds of thousands of documents into the public domain. She saw one document, which to her mind seemed to show that the processes of the United Nations were being corrupted by the British and the American governments. She felt, as an employee of GCHQ, that this was a step too far, that this is not the sort of work that the intelligence services should be expected to do. And she leaked that one single document. And as soon as she was interrogated, she initially said that it wasn't her, but very quickly she couldn't live with herself, and so she confessed within days of the act, which she knew was a breach of the Official Secrets Act. So yes, I mean, I do think she is she's an immensely brave woman. My feeling, as a reporter, is that though latterly I've become friends with Catherine and that I have the deepest respect for what she did, and I think she was right, at the time I was, I think, quite properly agnostic. I think as a reporter, you're not supposed to take sides. I mean, I may have had my own personal views, but even my own personal views were very mixed because we didn't know how the war would turn out. I, like many members of the British public, I think, hoped that there'd be some sort of democratic domino effect. So personally, I was neither a gung-ho supporter nor a vocal opponent. As a journalist, I think it was very important to remain neutral. That's not to say that latterly now, I don't believe that Catherine was hugely heroic in what she did.
And do you think, I mean, one of the reasons, the book and now the film, is do you think Catherine's role in this has become somewhat overlooked in the overall narrative of what happened in Iraq?
Very much so. She was not part of any of the main inquiries. Her story was not part of any of the main inquiries. And I think some of that was to do with the fact that the story broke so close to the outbreak of war itself. So he broke the story at the beginning of March, and by the middle of March we were at war in 2003. So we found ourselves, I suppose, scooped by a bigger story, which was the story of the war. At the same time, I mean, the story wasn't followed up by the American media particularly. It was very big for about a week, and then it was largely forgotten. But in a way, that's the attraction of the film. The attraction of the film is this is one of the untold stories of the Iraq War. It's a very specific incident involving one single document and one woman's journey, one woman's conscience. So the fact that we've been able to bring to an international audience this story that had been largely forgotten is for me wonderful. It's one of the proudest elements of the film, I think, for me.
And rightly, Catherine is the central focus of the film. But one of the things I think the film does well is it really showcases your job as journalist. It actually, Matt, conveys your neutrality. You're doing your job as a journalist. If it's true, we'll print it. The reservations that not only that you had about verifying it and so on, well, that could have actually been quite a procedural, boring movie. I mean, a lot of my job is quite boring in a sense. I just reply to emails. But, you know, I think it really did distill, you know, the risks editorially that you took as well.
It was very important for the director to have a film that was as close to real events as possible without being immensely dull and just a series of phone calls and a series of meetings in cafes. The newsroom scenes are very close to what happened in reality, and it was crucial for Gavin Hood to demonstrate that in parallel to Catherine being someone within that organisation who was doing her job, there were the journalists in the Observer newsroom who were also being shown to do their job. In a sense, this is a celebration of the people at the time who were doing their job properly in times of immense pressure. Pressure from government, pressure from, in our case, pressure from other journalists who were towing the government line. And in Catherine's case, pressure from a system that meant that if she were to blow the whistle, then she was liable to end up in prison. So in that way, this is a celebration of people just getting on with things and doing things properly.
The agony I had watching it is because whilst I think she was right, we've also as a state got to protect the integrity of our intelligence community, and I wouldn't want some lefty to join GCHQ with the express intent to do it. So there has to be the full force of the law. In a sense, I'm glad she was charged, but I'm glad that she was acquitted, if that makes sense, because... I mean, even though she paid a terrible price for it, I also felt that it's this awkward thing as a society that we have to hold our intelligence community to account. But how do we even do that? Because we obviously can't know what they're doing, because then our enemies will.
That's right. I hope that this isn't a tub-thumping, clichéd anti-war movie. It's certainly not the way I look at it. And several people who've seen preview screenings who were either supporters of the war or neutral have commented that it's a film that does hold all those ambiguities and all those paradoxes in a very fine balance. So the viewer is invited to ask precisely the questions you've just asked, Paul. The question of whether you have, as a member of the intelligence services or an employee generally, a loyalty to the contract that you've signed, the contract of confidentiality, the loyalty to your state, the loyalty to your country, and the way that those conflicting loyalties play with an individual is a very important part of this film. I think what this comes down to is ultimately we're asking the question here, or we're invited to ask the question, as to whether those major institutions, be it the intelligence services, parliament, the fourth estate, the media, the diplomatic service, the legal system, were, again, doing their jobs during this period. You know, were they corrupted? Were they undermined? Was the pressure brought to bear in order to bring us to the point of intervention too much for those institutions to bear? I think that plays out really wonderfully through this film, where those questions are asked.
For me as well, it showed the rigidity and the lack of flexibility that those state institutions has, because I don't think there was a conspiracy to silence, in a sense. It was more that just everything was so wound up that the people felt they had no choice, and ultimately it meant that an individual was in effect bullied by the state, because systemically it wasn't set up to deal with something like this. A just whistleblower.
Yes, that's the real central theme of the film is how does a state deal with someone who has revealed wrongdoing at the heart of government, but done it in a way that is a black and white case of breaking the law?
Yeah, I would say technical breach of the law, but I mean, clearly laws are not morals.
That's
she
right.
did break the law,
the
in
official
my view,
secret, the
but she didn't do anything wrong morally. Mm.
The Official Secrets Act is a very blunt instrument. The Official Secrets Act does not have a public interest defence. You cannot say that you breached the Official Secrets Act because of your conscience. If you breach the Official Secrets Act, you are guilty. And she was, on the face of it, completely guilty. She took a document.
It's a so-called strict liability offence, isn't it? Like
absolutely.
A parking ticket.
Exactly.
You don't have to prove intent. You just have to prove that you were there, you were driving, you parked the car there, and you're guilty.
Exactly right. And she admitted it. And so she had no defence, really. What's fascinating, of course, is that her lawyers... So there's a part of the film where the journalists pass the baton to Catherine's lawyers. And... those lawyers developed an ingenious defence, the defence of necessity, where they argued that she had to do what she did because she was, in effect, under the belief that Britain was about to embark on an illegal war. And so she was saving lives that would have been lost unlawfully.
One of the other things that I think the film depicted accurately is the fact that the Observer itself was conflicted as an institution, as a newspaper, in terms of what the attitude to the war was. I know that the editor was backing it, but a lot of the staff were opposed. And I think those scenes portray that quite accurately.
It was a very difficult time for the Observer. I'm not entirely sure the Observer has as yet recovered from the wounds of that period. The Observer, traditionally, certainly in recent memory, it's a very old newspaper, but in recent memory, the Observer has always been a liberal newspaper. So the decision by the editor, Roger Alton, to support the government in its intervention in Iraq was very controversial. It led to lots of readers cancelling their subscriptions. And for staff as well, it was a very difficult moment. I hope that the film represents accurately the fact that there are legitimate differences within a newsroom, always, that people are always arguing about whether one story is better than another or whether one story deserves to go in the paper or not, or what. And in particular, it was very important with this story that we proved that we made sure that the story was true, that the memo that was sent from the National Security Agency in the States to GCHQ in the UK was real. So people within the newsroom, including the political editor Kamal Ahmed, was very keen to demonstrate that this was real, that there was a legitimate scepticism within the newsroom. I think it's probably for others to say whether during that period the Observer and its senior staff were too close to government. Those claims have been made, and it's always a risk. It's always a risk. I was a political journalist myself, a political editor of the New Statesman during the Brown government, and the strain on political journalists, particularly if you are sympathetic to a particular political party, it is very difficult to maintain your independence. And I think that independence was hugely put under strain during that period at The Observer.
It's always difficult. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking of Terry White, the editor-in-chief of of Empire, the movie magazine. She was sitting in that chair a few weeks ago. And she was saying that there's a tension that she covers the movie industry, she covers films. But they also have to have the right, as independent journalists and critics, to say that last film in the Marvel Universe wasn't very good. But on the other hand, you're reliant on the studios to keep giving you news and access to their stars and directors and so on. So there's always a tension there. And it's similar in politics, isn't it? I mean, if, for example, like when Tony Blair blanked the Today programme, they can never get the Prime Minister on. I mean, that can't be healthy either. So how do you maintain a positive working relationship with him that isn't about then just being, you know, merely sycophantic and still holding them to account?
I think there are strict ethical lines to be drawn here. It's, of course, utterly legitimate for the comment pages of a national newspaper to be full of opinions of all sorts. And it's perfectly legitimate for senior columnists to take positions. It's also legitimate within the British newspaper culture for newspapers to take lines, for newspapers end up supporting particular political parties in the run-up to election, and newspapers take a particular line on huge issues of national importance, such as intervention in wars. So again, I think it's perfectly legitimate for an editor to decide that the newspaper should take a particular stance. But that shouldn't really affect the reporting. I think the reporters should, in their professional life and in their reporting of the news, remain neutral as much as possible and report the facts. And there was some blurring of those lines at The Observer during that period. There were stories that appeared in the pages of The Observer
as news
that came directly from propaganda sources. Now, latterly, The Observer has apologised for that. But at the time, that was, I think, a dark period for The Observer's journalism.
And is it as easy from a kind of corporate governance point of view to simply take the old way out, which is to just jettison the editor? Oh, you know, that was the previous guy. We sacked him. You know, the king is dead. Long live the king. And then the Observer reboots under a new editor, because it seemed that was, even then, was hanging over them reputationally for a long time.
I think it's still hanging over The Observer. And the difficulty, I think, for a paper like The Observer is that this is an ancient institution. It's the oldest Sunday newspaper in the world. It has certain traditions and it has certain loyalties. I still feel sentimentally and emotionally attached to that newspaper. It was the most wonderful place to work. My colleagues were fantastic. And I think the 9 years I spent at The Observer were the happiest professional years of my journalistic career. So people are hugely attached to that institution in a way that they aren't in quite the same way to other media institutions. So when things unraveled in the wake of the decision to back the Iraq intervention, I think people felt it really personally. People who had that personal attachment, either as journalists or as readers. And that's not to say, again, that I'm not really talking here about whether or not you supported intervention. My great friend and colleague Nick Cohen, we disagreed on the war. You know, he was a supporter of intervention, remains a supporter of intervention, but at the same time, I'm sure if he was sitting here today, he would have huge reservations about the way that The Observer went in those days.
Well, particularly, he's expressed them many times. I'm a huge fan of Nick's writing, and I've also been proud to know him for many, many years. He's a legend. He's a raving secularist like I am. So I often come across him at various humanist events and things like that. But how much pressure did you come under personally then in terms of political pressure? I mean, I know it was almost a cliche, but it was done very well, is, you know, there was the underground car park scene, wasn't there? Was that something that you insisted be put in?
Yeah, the underground car park scene was, I think it was an essential visual joke that had to go into the film. There was a lot of discussion about you know, the details of where I met my contacts, you know, where we had our conversations. And of course, a lot of those conversations happened either on the phone or in cafes. In fact, I think probably all the contacts that I made during that period happened either on the phone or in a cafe. And the director said, look, we can't just have every scene in a cafe.
The problem is meeting someone in an underground car park is in itself suspicious. It's the opposite now, isn't it, of keeping a low profile. It would draw attention to it.
Exactly, yeah.
Why are those two people stood in the dark there in the corner?
Well, especially as my contact was Yvonne Ridley, and she's shown in the film to be wearing hijab. So, you know, pretty conspicuous person to be meeting in an underground car park. So, yeah, I mean, that was a little bit of cinematic license that was taken with that particular meeting. I think at one point I meet another contact in his gentleman's club as well, which is to give a little bit of colour and a little bit of an establishment vibe.
I would insist that you meet them there from now on. That seems exactly, like
yeah. More, I'm not sure that I actually met him in his gentleman's club at that point, although I had at some point.
But were you... I mean, clearly, you're a journalist of very strong integrity. You would resist any nobbling. But were you nobbled? Did someone try to have a discreet word in your shell like?
Not on that story. And no, I mean, it was more, if anything, it was the opposite. If anything, there were people giving me and my colleagues strong hints that something was not right with intelligence and something was not right with the onward thrust towards war, and that we weren't picking up the signs. There was a huge degree of, as we now know from the various inquiries, there was a huge amount of establishment disquiet about what was happening. And I think, again, to return to this theme of people doing their jobs, looking back, there were a number of people from within the intelligence community who, and I think probably within government as well, who were urging us on, not explicitly, but hoping that we would do our jobs better. And that's certainly true in the States as well, that there were people within the establishment who just couldn't believe that the media weren't interrogating power in a more aggressive manner. That, you know, journalists that were simply taking the government line and sticking it in the newspapers is something that, you know, collectively we can all be ashamed of, I think.
Why do you think standards in journalism slipped so much in that period? Is this an ongoing problem that there's fewer journalists in newsrooms? I mean, what is this? I mean, you know, I've seen All the President's Men. I understand things are different now, but is it just that there's no money in journalism anymore, so it doesn't attract the best people? And what was the kind of systemic collective loss of our marbles that happened at the time journalistically?
There were resource issues. I think it was the beginning of the collapse in confidence of the press. It was the beginning. There were scenes in the film where we show the story first emerging onto the internet, early days of the internet, early days of a particularly virulent form of journalism, sort of muckraking journalism online, as represented by the Drudge Report in the States. And I think that it was the beginning of that undermining of confidence that journalists had. There was a period where we felt that we were, rightly or wrongly, untouchable, that we had this role that meant that we could hold power to account. And I think one of the things that the Blair administration understood very well was that journalists could be browbeaten, journalists could be bullied, seduced, persuaded, and they played
made
that game very well.
With either carrot or stick.
Exactly right. So I think this goes back to my point, really, that what happened around the Iraq war was undermining of a number of institutions, including the media. But looking back on it, one can only feel nostalgic, really. I mean, the point was, we still felt that if we got it right, we could hold those institutions to account. We could hold those political figures to account. We did feel that, you know, if you got the story right and you could prove that the American and British governments had fixed the vote to go to war, and then you asked politicians in a press conference, you know, did you do this, did you not do this, you could embarrass them, that there was a compact between the political class and the media that meant that if you caught people out in a lie, it mattered. Whereas I'm not sure that holds anymore. And you know, I think there's a link between what happened around the time of the Iraq war and what's happening now, where senior politicians in America and in Britain systematically dissemble. And when you catch them out telling untruths, they don't care.
It's the most frightening development of the last few years that people have alternative facts, that, you know, even when I was in politics, you could disagree over the means to the end, but you could always, no one would argue that, you know, there's been a certain number of more nurseries under Showstart. You know, the actual number of new nurseries was never in dispute, whereas now it'll be like, it's all fake news. People just don't care. It's very scary as a journalist.
Yes, that contract has been broken. I think, you know, one of the most extraordinary symbolic moments happened when the Prime Minister of the UK can be challenged by a member of the public in a hospital, and his first instinct when challenged about the presence of the media is to say, there's no press here.
On camera.
Yeah. The first instinct, when the first instinct of a politician is to lie, I think you've got to be worried.
My dad gave me some advice about hiring people many years ago. I had a member of my team over a decade ago that lied to me about something quite small. And he said, sack them, because if they'll lie to you over something that small, imagine if they've got something big that they don't want you to know. Because, of course, you think, well, it was only an inconsequential thing. But, yeah, it's that first, the default to untruthfulness immediately.
Yeah,
I think it's worrying.
I think it's very difficult. And it does make the job of journalists very difficult, because you have to work as journalists within an Enlightenment environment, certainly at the more serious end of journalism. You have to assume that facts matter. You have to assume that your job is to dig out truths, objective truths, and to tell the public about them. Now, I mean, that doesn't mean that there isn't a role for, you know, I'm not so pure that I don't believe there isn't a role for gossip and fun and entertainment within
the diary column of any paper, so I go straight to it. Not on the letters page.
But even there, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Even within the diary column, what you want is truths.
Of course.
I mean, it may be salacious, but you want truths. You want to be able to...
It's not fun to read if it's not true. It's just fiction. I'd go and read a novel.
Yeah. So, you know, these are troubling developments.
Is it reputationally challenging or worrying for you when you do break a big story? Because there's always that worry, of course, that despite your best efforts, you might have genuinely got something wrong, made a mistake. There's a great scene in the film. I've obviously seen a preview of it. where someone had spell-checked the American memo and anglicised the spelling, and that's why it didn't get as big a coverage, you know, as because the Americans had written it off as a fake. And, of course, it was really just been some enthusiastic sub-editor had run it through a spell-check, thinking they were doing a good job. And, of course, that cataclysmically undermined the early perception of it. What was your thought when you saw that mistake?
At the time, it was, it was a terrible moment. The moment that... Again, it was the Drudge Report that pointed out that the spelling on the document that we printed on the front page of the newspaper was spelt in British spelling and not American spelling. So how, they said, could it come from the American intelligence services?
It's not an unreasonable question to ask.
It's not an unreasonable question. And for that moment, when you print a story like that, I think we were 99% sure by the time we published that it was the real deal. But there's always a doubt. You always wonder.
But I like the process in the film, because there was that doubt where you went straight over to the original document to check.
Yeah.
Because actually, facts are facts.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a matter of speculation. There was a 1% chance you'd made a mistake.
Yeah.
The only way to work out whether you had or not was to go to the desk, open the drawer and pick up the damn memo.
Yeah, I still have sleepless nights when I've taken back to that moment where I did pull that drawer open.
I'm laughing at your suffering
it was really, imagine you're pulling it open.
Oh, well, it was very well represented in the film. I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. I love that moment in the film because I think it is symbolic of precisely the problem that we've been discussing, which is
commitment
to
truth.
The problem of commitment to truth. And that early instinct by a right wing website in the States to where something didn't look like it was convenient for their political point of view to claim that it's fake news. You know, fake news.
Yeah, they overdid it. In my view, though, it was, as I say, it was reasonable of them to at least ask the question. But, you know, ultimately they were wrong factually because it was all it had been spell-checked.
By which time, of course, it was too late to turn the tanker around.
That's the problem, isn't it?
But it was an important moment. It's a comical moment in the film, but it's actually, I think, one of the thematic hearts of the movie is this idea that, you know, everything hangs on the veracity of that memo.
But another great thing about the film, though, is even though the lady in the film that was depicted as having made the mistake, I felt desperately sorry for her because you were entitled to be angry. You know, this had fatally, in that moment, undermined it.
Yeah.
And yet I also had some human empathy for her because we've all dropped clangers from time to time. She clearly meant well. She just also massively balls the job up.
Yeah, Nicole, it was her first week at the paper.
Oh, God.
She was, in fact, she was a new desk assistant. She wasn't even a sub editor, and she'd been asked to. She'd just been asked to type up the original memo so that we could put it on the front page. And I think a really legitimate question is why none of us more senior people had checked it through. I mean, it should have been checked by the sub editors. It should have been checked by me. It should have been checked by the editor. It wasn't really her fault. She wasn't even a journalist, really. She was effectively a secretary.
I hope she was still given a sound beating, though, because that would have made me feel better in the moment.
She was treated with great decency. She's seen the film. She's now a very, very respected magazine journalist, in fact. So Nicole, yes, has been very, very generous, considering that she's represented at the heart of the movie as making a catastrophic error.
It's the problem that I have with the way society views criminals, because I originally did a law degree and did some shadowing of barristers and so on, and even though you're in the court and you're looking at people who've done armed robbery, you know, I can obviously condemn what they do and it's right that they be punished, but I also felt a tiny bit sorry for them as well, because clearly they've been backed into a corner, they've made the wrong choices in that moment, but I think you can still have human empathy for people who are quote unquote horrible people.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily categorize Nicole in as being the same as an armed robber.
No,
but not did I
in fairness.
but I think that's, I mean, one of the joys of there are certain characters in this film. With certain characters in the newsroom and certain characters within the legal profession who I think it's fair to say don't come out of the film entirely positively.
Yeah, DPP, Ken for one.
Yeah,
Ken
McDonald, the Director of Public Prosecutions, and Kamal Ahmed, who's was then the political editor of the paper. However, I think it's really important to show that the decisions they were making were troubled, that they were not bad people. They were thinking hard about what they were doing. In the case of Ken McDonald, he was in a very, very difficult position of prosecuting a woman who had confessed to what she'd done. And at the same time, he knew that if that case went to trial, it was going to be extremely difficult for the government. And he was going to struggle to fight her defence of necessity. And similarly, I think within the newsroom...
Could he not prosecute, though? Because even then he has a duty to prosecute.
He has a duty to prosecute, but he has a duty as well to pursue...
The second test, of course, is the public interest.
He had a test of public interest, but also he had to show that he had a reasonable chance of success. So...
That's the first test.
Yeah. He had to make sure that as time went on, it became clear to him that it was not going to have a reasonable chance of success. And so I can understand that is a very, very difficult... That the position of Director of Public Prosecutions is a very difficult one. And I hope we show that the discussions and the thought processes he was going through were not simple. And similarly, it is the job of a senior journalist within a newsroom to be sceptical about a story that, if wrong, could be devastating for that newspaper.
But just to return to you coming under pressure then, I mean, you have come into conflict with the Spooks before, memorably over David Schiller.
Mm. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, earlier in my career, the Observer was challenged by the intelligence services. We did have Special Branch arriving at the newspaper and demanding all our documents that related to the David Schiller case. David Schiller was famously an MI5 officer who leaked a number of documents about a series of incidents ranging from minor administrative errors within the intelligence services right up to what he claimed was an attempt to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. So we were working with David, and the police came and wanted evidence to help them prosecute him. We refused and were, on the face of it, in contempt of court because the police had demanded that we cooperate. We refused. And we fought that to judicial review. And it was a very, very difficult, very, very difficult period for me, Roger Alton, who was the editor at that point, and indeed Alan Rusbridger, who was the editor-in-chief of the Guardian Observer Group. And it was a post-run thing.
Did you have some sympathy with the police, though? Because they can't pick and choose the people. If there's evidence that you had breached the Official Secrets Act or were in some form of conspiracy, they have a duty to investigate. I don't want you to be arrested for it and searched, but I also don't blame the coppers that turned up because...
I think
this is such a delicate...
It is delicate. I mean,
constitutional problem.
I think there are a couple of elements to this that... that I've had to think about over the years. I think, generally speaking, the police shouldn't come to journalists for their evidence. I think they should do their job elsewhere. In that case, they really didn't need us to help them prove that case. Mm. They really didn't. It was too much. They went too far, and that was what the judges decided in the end, was that that they had no reason to come and invade our privacy. In fact, the final deciding judge, the rather wonderfully named Igor Judge... Judge.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Justice Judge, as he was originally. Yeah.
I am the law.
Oh, he ended up.
You know, he went back to the phrase, an Englishman's home is his castle. That was one of his final rhetorical flourishes, that you have to have a pretty good excuse to in English law to invade someone's home. So in that case, yes, I had some sympathy, I guess, for the police in trying to do their jobs. But I think they did overstep the mark on that one.
You joined the Tony Blair Faith Foundation. Was it disappointing that it didn't live up to your expectations? I mean, we mentioned Nick Cohen earlier. He's a raving secularist like me. I was an uber Blairite. I used to joke with Tony that, you know, he wasn't Blairite enough for me. But, you know, I strongly disagreed with him on matters of faith. I had no problem with being a Blairite that also was a secularist and campaigned against faith schools. My view is they're social selection masked as religious selection. And it's the old get on your knees to avoid the fees. What was your journey there with that?
Well, we could have a whole other conversation about faith schools, and I think we'd be pretty much aligned on that. But, yeah, joining the Tony Blair Faith Foundation was not the greatest decision of my life, I have to say. But I entered that relationship in good faith, and I had my disagreements with Tony Blair over the years. I was not a Blairite, and yet I felt that he had a certain insight into the importance of faith within conflicts. So over the years, historically, we had failed to understand that faith mattered. It may not matter to you or to me, but to people of faith, it has a huge importance. So traditionally and sociologically, we thought about conflict in terms of geopolitics or in terms of power. And people had seen faith as something of a side issue.
Sam Harris wrote a book called The End of Faith, which was an amazing book, and it really reframed my view on this, because he said when we talk about 9/11, for example, we talk about it in terms of geopolitics and so on. He said no one actually considered that the terrorists genuinely believed in the religious element of what they were doing, and they thought that they were doing God's work.
That's right, that's right. I think it's hugely important, and it's not good enough to say that, you know, a la Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins, you know, these poor fools should not believe this stuff. I mean, you or I, again, may believe that, but it's not useful in terms of geopolitics because people do believe this stuff.
But was Sam Harris's point, is that we can't truly engage with people of faith because we just can't work. We can't look at it through their lens.
Exactly. That was my motivation for joining the Faith Foundation. I felt that there was an important role for an analysis of the role that faith plays in geopolitics. So I was pleased to have the opportunity to set up what was a combination of a website and a news service looking at conflicts around the world and the role that faith played in them. And we did a good job. It was we were on limited resources, but you know the site that we created was excellent. The problem was ultimately Tony Blair himself. That Tony Blair has a particular view. Again, this is a question of the difference between ideology and journalistic neutrality. I was entering this as a journalist and an interested journalist and. To a certain extent, there was an academic element to it as well. But Tony Blair genuinely believed that there were good people of faith and bad people of faith, and that there was a perverted version of Islam and other faiths, that if you could only find a good version, then everything would in some way be right with the world. And my first month there, I think, we were to be involved with the Harvard Divinity School. It's a very, very well-respected theological institution. And they pulled out of the relationship, and that really did trouble me. And they pulled out because of a piece that Tony Blair had written about good and bad Islam. And it's the generally held academic view, and I think probably for me an ethical view as well, that it's not really for us to judge what is a good and bad version of Islam. It's certainly not for Tony Blair to judge. And it meant that we were in a position where, particularly after a speech that that Blair gave at Bloomberg, where he suggested that we pragmatically had to ally ourselves with certain forms of what I would call extreme Islam in order to fight other forms of extreme Islam. So to his mind, it was okay to ally with Saudi Arabia if you were fighting ISIS.
My enemy's enemy is my friend.
Exactly. It seemed to me that he was ripping up everything that he previously said about humanitarian intervention or an ethical foreign policy, where you are not talking about realpolitik, you're talking about making moral judgments.
Which he was.
And the idea that you would make common cause with, say, Saudi Arabia or Russia or Assad or the new regime in Egypt, the al-Sisi regime, because the true evil was the evil of al-Qaeda or ISIS, struck me as misplaced, and that's when I left.
And you investigated the rise of politicised Islam in the UK whilst working for The Observer and latterly for the New Statesman. Was that a controversial topic in itself for people on the left? Your readers?
Yeah, to put it mildly. Yes, it was, because... And I'd become increasingly worried by the way that, almost unthinkingly, people on the left, and actually people within the Blair government, had made common cause with some unsavoury elements within the politicised Muslim community. I mean, some of this was entirely cynical for reasons of the particular constituencies that certain MPs had, Jack Straw in particular. But some of it was to do with a failure to understand where those movements were coming from. I was particularly interested in the origins of the Muslim Council of Britain, which represented itself as a neutral body that that represented all Muslims in Britain. In fact, it had its origins in a much more radical form of political Islam within Pakistan and Bangladesh, Jamaat Islami, which in itself was allied to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, you can make all sorts of judgments about where those organisations are on the political panoply, but they are certainly not neutral. And, you know, there are certain forms of Islam they don't accept, and it meant that those representative institutions were dominated by a particular form of very political Islam. And that made me feel very uncomfortable. Now, I think at the time, a lot of people in the Labour Party were completely unaware. For me, it was a form of racism. It was a failure to understand that it is... You're not talking about unsophisticated constituents who don't quite understand the way things work. You're talking about very, very sophisticated political organisations, in some cases far more sophisticated than the Labour Party, far more organised, internationalised, and with a particular agenda. So I felt that we just had to look very carefully about where these people were coming from. And it did prove very, very unpopular within certain sections of the left.
You were the first non-Jewish political editor of the Jewish Chronicle. What was that like? And it was obviously before the rise of Corbynism. Are you shocked at the increasing amount of anti-Semitism coming from the hard left?
I'm probably less shocked about that anti-Semitism than others would be, because I come from the left. I understand the left. I knew where these people had come from. I'd made a documentary for Channel 4 about Ken Livingstone, and I knew that there were elements of certainly hardline hostility to Israel, and also a degree of acceptance that radical Islam was a legitimate resistance movement on the lines of the ANC. There was an idea that organisations such as Hamas were a legitimate radical opposition to Israel. So I was probably more aware than most of where that was coming from. I have, however, been shocked at the scale of the anti-Semitism that's entered the bloodstream of conventional politics in the UK. And I think it is ultimately Corbyn's legacy that he has allowed he has allowed anti-Semitism to enter the mainstream of British politics. I never thought I'd see that happen.
I'm utterly, profoundly and genuinely disgusted by it, including holding Corbyn, in my view, personally liable for this. It's even worse, though, in my view, with those people on the left, because if you point out actual instances of anti-Semitism, rather than having an open mind thinking, wow, I don't think I'm anti-Semitic, but here you are presenting some evidence that I might have got a blind spot, they go, oh, you must be part of the Murdoch conspiracy against us, you're now part of the problem. I mean, it's breathtaking close-mindedness built on racism.
That is what has shifted. That I can remember as you say, I was the first non-Jewish political editor of the Jewish Chronicle. I learnt a lot there while I was there. And, yeah, I just became a little bit tired towards my end of my time at the Jewish Chronicle of, I suppose, what I call anti-Semite spotting. Because there are people out there who just don't understand the tropes. I can remember ringing a very long-standing Labour figure, MP, Paul Flynn. And he'd made some comments about the then British ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gould, who was the first Jewish British ambassador to Israel. And he questioned his loyalty. He said, you know, how can we know that, you know, he'll have split loyalty?
That is outrageous of him to say that.
It is outrageous of him to say. And I rang him and I think he genuinely didn't know that was a classic anti-Semitic trope. He should have done.
But is benevolently held racism or still racism?
I know. I mean, but I did. I rang him. He was mortified. He was genuinely upset. I was over the phone, so I don't know. But it seemed to me that he was. He may even have been crying. He was really, really upset. And I think there are those sorts of people where there's a process of education where, you know, I know that Paul Flynn, in his heart of hearts, didn't think of himself as racist and would have been horrified. And once I explained it to him, there was a kind of moment of realisation for
mea culpa.
You shouldn't have said it. Now, what's different is politicians on the hard left for whom that kind of instinct is written into their politics.
Badge of honour.
Yeah. So I'd written stories about Jeremy Corbyn over the years. I'd written about his invitation to Raed Salah, who is the leader of the opposition to Israel from within Israel's own Palestinian community. And that was a terrible thing to do. It was a terrible thing for Jeremy Corbyn to do, to invite that individual into Parliament. What was interesting to me was that even I, in that privileged situation, hadn't quite understood the visceral difficulty that the Jewish community have with people like Jeremy Corbyn. So when he was nominated and then elected as leader of the Labour Party, even I hadn't realised just how serious this was.
Mm. I didn't, and
I got calls from Jewish friends and prominent members of the Jewish community saying, how can this be allowed to happen? And in fact, at the time, I was helping David Lammy in an advisory role with his mayoral campaign to become the Labour mayoral candidate, and he had backed Jeremy Corbyn, nominated Jeremy Corbyn.
So did Sadiq Khan. So did many of them. If anything, there was
no understanding. You know, for people who are not Jewish, there is not that visceral understanding of the position that people like Jeremy Corbyn have played on the left over the years. And that was a real eye-opener for me. So yes, I understood it. I knew where they come from. I'd made the programme about Ken Livingstone. I'd written about Jeremy Corbyn. But the genuine feeling of horror when this man became the leader of a mainstream political party, you know, that was something that I hadn't quite fully understood myself.
And it's the law of unforeseen consequences, isn't it? Because when I joined the Labour Party over two decades ago, I couldn't even vote for our local council candidate until I'd been a member a year, just to utterly rule out the fact that I was an imposter from the local Tories. Whereas, you know, when you look at what Ed Miliband and Ray Collins did, I think they did it altruistically to say, look, we should encourage more people to be members of the party. You should be able to join for £3 and vote for your leader straight away. And of course, not linking the fact that it's so easy to whip up several hundred 100,000 lefties, you know, on Twitter via social media. And of course, I mean, I have friends that were members of the Conservative Party that joined Labour to vote for Corbyn. I mean, it was a disaster waiting to happen.
Yes, it was. It was, as you say, it's the law of unforeseen circumstances, and it clearly was not Ed Miliband's intention that this should happen. But it has ended up hollowing out a once great party. It's a, you know, it is a different thing now. It is a party that represents that particular kind of politics. And if people want to go down that road, then we have an open society, and that's up to them. But I fear that we've got to a position, in fact, with both our major parties now, that that we are seeing a rush to the extremes, and there is no place for moderate politics in the two dominant political forces in this country, which is a scary moment to be at.
How would you describe yourself now? Because I hate the phrase portfolio career, but, you know, you're producing movies, you've got your non-profit, which I'd like you to tell our listeners about in a second. It's very exciting. Would you still think of yourself as a journalist, or are you a commentator, mm-hmm. polemicist, writer? What, when you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror, what do you describe yourself as?
Yeah, I certainly don't describe myself as a movie producer.
Well, but, I saw your name on the credits.
But I think there is, whenever I talk about my work, even as the chief executive of a very small charity, I always describe myself as a journalist by instinct. I fell into journalism as a career. I didn't train as a journalist. I began by reviewing books and films and ended up as an investigative journalist. Journalism found me. I found that I could do it. I loved it and ended up breaking some big stories. That is what I do by instinct. I'm not by instinct someone who would find themselves working in the charitable sector. That happened by accident.
How did that happen? How did that come about?
It was when I was working at the New Statesman. I was working as political editor there. My job every week was to sound off and tell politicians where they were going wrong.
Great job.
It's a good job. It's a good job. It's kind of power with absolutely no accountability.
Even better. That's the kind of power I want.
So yeah, week after week, I'd say where Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister at the time, was going wrong. By 2008, the economy was in state of collapse, and we were hitting the recession. And already, the government had come up with various ideas of how to get people back to work. You know, unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, was becoming a problem, or it was a problem they saw that was likely to get worse. And I felt that some of the solutions that Brown was coming up with were, let's say, typically Gordonish. So the idea was, in a very austere kind of way, that you would get everybody laying broadband cables and lagging people's roofs, and, you know, this would get people back to work in
the
a
New
perfectly,
Deal,
perfectly, yeah, perfectly legitimate way, a perfectly honourable way, but a slightly dull way. And I felt, you know what, you know, I'd been unemployed in the 80s. The idea of getting back to work laying broadband cables would have been,
sorry, that's laughable.
I just wouldn't have been very good at it. So I thought there's got to be a better way of doing this. I looked back at the...
It's slightly patronising, isn't it, that you should roll your sleeves and want to dig up the ground to lay a cable?
Yeah, I mean, for some people, fine. But
no, and I would if necessary, you know, for family to support, blah, blah, blah. Of course I would. No job is too demeaning. But on the other hand, that why should you? That can't be the only thing you're offered, is the point I was making.
Yeah, and also there was also during the New Labour period, a lot of rhetoric about the creative industries being our greatest asset. So I said, why don't you just match the rhetoric of work creation with the rhetoric about creative industries and try to put people back to work in the creative sector? And luckily enough, at the time, had lots of contacts within the government. James Purnell and Andy Burnham. James Purnell was then the Work and Pension Secretary, and Andy Burnham was the Culture Secretary. They're very, very supportive of the idea of getting people back to work in the creative sector. There was a scheme called the Future Jobs Fund, where people were given employers were given a government subsidy of, I think it's about £6,000, the equivalent of a part-time job for 6 months, to put people back to work. And Purnell and Burnham carved out a certain number of those jobs for the creative sector. And yeah, I set up my charity to help put my shoulder to the wheel, I guess. I think in particular, Andy Burnham has said to me, you know, it's all very well you telling us what to do every week in your column. Why don't you actually do something about it yourself? And so it's something of a challenge to me, really, to what initially began as a campaign, then became a charity. We got a contract to do the to put about, in the end, it was over 1,000 people back to work in the creative sector. I'm very proud of what I did. I
mean, how's it going?
The whole thing has shifted enormously. So,
No plan ever survives contact with the enemy.
Exactly.
I think that's often misattributed to Hannibal, but the map is not the territory.
It's certainly the case for what I did. Yeah, I mean, I think when I initially made my pitch for a new way of doing things, there's a part of me that thought, you know, if they gave me a multi-million-pound quango to run, I think that would probably be about right.
I'm still open to all offers, by the way, for any multi-million-dollar or pound quangos, if any listeners
they
want run badly.
They thought that maybe a journalist would not be the best person to do that. So
I think you're the best person to do it, because you believe in it. Like you say, it came from a genuine passion to do it, and you can't buy that.
It did come from a genuine passion. It came from my own experience of, I left university in the mid-80s with a good degree from a good university, but I didn't have any contacts. Neither of my parents went to university, moved to London, didn't know anyone. So I found myself at the job centre, and I thought, this is going to happen again. So initially it was just started really out of a sense of wanting to make a difference to the young people like myself with no contacts and no background in the creative industries trying to break in. So that's how it began. It really was a passion project. So we've been going for 10 years now. The Creative Society is established as a part of the landscape of people trying to help with the agenda of diversity and access, I suppose. And there's still a lot to be done. It is still increasingly difficult for people from non-traditional backgrounds to break into media, the arts, all these more glamorous ends of the industry. It's still a closed shop, particularly behind the scenes. So we now, what we concentrate now on much more is intensive mentoring, helping people with their own journey from, generally speaking, school leavers and graduates who wish to break into the creative industries, and we help them on that journey.
Is the problem that we don't think we're part of the problem because we're white, male, middle class, and we haven't suffered discrimination? Or, I mean, like you said, there's been a lack of opportunity, but how do we truly know what it is to be a young black woman from South London trying to get into the creative industries? Because that is not a life experience I have.
Yeah, an old friend of mine said the other day that he asked me whether it would be possible for a white middle class man to set up an organisation like that today, and there's a part of me that thinks maybe not, but at the same time I think it's important for people who are established within these industries to recognise that there's a problem and not to be embarrassed about the fact that we come from a very different background. I don't think we're anywhere near finding the solutions. But one thing's for sure, we do need to tap talent from all sorts of backgrounds. You know, one of the examples I often give is of Premiership football clubs. If Premiership football clubs only recruited from Eton, they wouldn't stay in the Premiership for very long. They understand that they have to find talent, you know, not just within the diverse communities of this country, but they need to recruit around the world, right? That's how they maintain their standards.
If you're good at footy, you're good at footy, no matter where you're from.
Exactly. Now, it's very different if you look behind the scenes in football, right? I mean, they don't apply those same criteria for people working in offices in Premiership football clubs. I think that's the difference. I think that where we can get away with it, we get away with it. The same is true, I think, for the music business, and the same is true for the film industry in terms of talent. In terms of talent, you wouldn't last 5 minutes if you only recruited from a certain area.
But we're missing out as a society if there's untapped talent.
We certainly
that
are.
Just comes from a lower or more challenged socioeconomic background. Yeah. I mean, that's I want good people in my company.
Yeah.
Ultimately, yeah. If some of my unconscious biases are meaning that I'm underexploiting that talent and not, then clearly that's everyone's losing. Like, they're going to lose because they've been denied an opportunity, and so have I.
Yeah. Now we need to change the way that we operate and the way that we think about these things. And at the same time, you need to recognise that people who've had a series of challenges along the way may also have challenges once they enter the world of work. So it's not enough simply to give the opportunities. And this is very difficult, particularly for smaller employers. It may be the case that people from the sort of backgrounds we're talking about are not job ready when they start at work, that there will be support that's needed for them. That is above and beyond your Russell Group graduate who can walk straight into a job with great confidence.
Last question then, because we're about to be thrown out of the studio. What's next for you? Are there any other periods in your life that are going to be brought to the silver screen? Does Hollywood beckon?
I think, yeah, Official Secrets, the small employment charity years is a film that no one would really want to see.
Well, if Keira Knightley's in it, frankly, I'd watch it. She's great. And Ralph Fiennes as well.
Yeah, how you could quite
maybe
do that,
Matt Smith could play you at different periods in your life. Maybe 20 years from now, I'll be playing you now.
I think Matt Smith has had enough of playing Martin Bright, frankly. But I do feel that, as I said, my instinct is journalistic. If I didn't do any journalism in the rest of my career, I think I would feel very unsatisfied. It will be varied. I mean, my career will have to be varied. Once you have set up your own thing, as I've done with Creative Society, it's very difficult to go back and work within a single institution. I like the fact that I can run my charity in parallel with other work. I've found the process of making a film extremely exciting. There was a review of Official Secrets that suggested that this type of filmmaking could be described as the fifth estate in parallel to the fourth estate with traditional journalism. And if I could find a way of helping filmmakers to make the sort of films that we've succeeded in doing with Official Secrets, that would be my favoured avenue, I think.
Martin, it's been a hugely, hugely interesting conversation. Thank you for your time.
It's been great. Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.